It seems we just never stop scribbling.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Don Doxey writes about sports in the Quad City Times and in his new book. We'll ask him about both, then on to the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor on Scribble. Don Doxey, is that allowed? You know, you write for a newspaper, but also write a book?
It is, yeah. I'm not sure that my employer knew I was writing the book, but when it came out, it's not like you can unpublish it, so.
Well, that's true. I mean, as long as you weren't writing on the job.
No.
But actually, writing about sports and then writing a book on sports, your daily work really informs what you do in the book.
It is. It kind of was a catalyst because this book kind of sprang out of things that I did in my day-to-day job with the Quad City Times, and largely because a guy named Gene Baker, who I'd written stories about, he was from Davenport, and I'd written stories when he was inducted into the Quad City Sports Hall of Fame, and that got me interested in him and thinking that maybe he could be the subject of an entire book or part of a book. As it is, he's one chapter in this book. So really what I did at the Quad City Times about Gene Baker kind of led to this book.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide the sport to fixate on?
Well, I've always loved baseball history. Going back to as a kid watching Cubs games with my grandfather, and he had seen Tinker to Evers to Chance and all these old Cub players. And, of course, baseball kind of lends itself to conversation. So during breaks in the action, he'd tell me about all these players he'd seen. And, I never forgot all that. And it's kind of – so I've always had a lifelong interest in baseball history.
You share the idea I heard somewhere once – I guess it's been around a long time – that baseball is the really mythic sport. That is, the universe – is your field. If you could hit a ball far enough, it could go into orbit, you know, and there's no real end to the game. Football ends when the clock ends, but that isn't true. Baseball could go on to eternity.
And it's the game that hasn't changed that much. I mean, you can compare players of today to players from 100 years ago. Sports like basketball didn't hardly exist 100 years ago, and football, it would be ludicrous to make those comparisons. But baseball, you can. It really hasn't changed that much, so you can make those sort of comparisons. And I think that lends itself to the historical aspect.
Well, not only mythic, but as a Cubs fan, a hint of tragedy as well.
Yes, and unfortunately, I am a Cubs fan.
Well, as long as we're here, how are they going to do this year, Don?
Well, obviously they're doing great, and it's kind of hard to contain your enthusiasm because we've been let down so many times before. We've had our hopes build up and had them dashed, so it's a little hard to restrain yourself with the way this season's gone. But yeah, certainly. I'm optimistic that this could be the year.
How did you make the selection? Which people you're going to write about?
Well, I tried to pick someone at each position. And as I got into it, I mean, it kind of started with Gene Baker. But I also, everybody knows about Bob Feller. And I'd actually met a few of the other people in the book. And I started looking into it. And it kind of worked out from the state of Iowa. There's one or two really good players at each position. So it wasn't that difficult to pick them out.
So these are all Iowa baseball players.
They are. They are all
natives
of Iowa. Oh, for one thing, I live in Iowa.
Okay.
I'm originally from Illinois, but that's a good question, I guess. But, Gene Baker, I got interested in, as I said, was from Iowa, and I was intrigued by Bob Feller and some others. And as I got into it, I found all these other players from Iowa who were just fascinating that I didn't know as much about until I started researching the book. And you know, to do a book about players from Illinois, you've got a much bigger pool. It would be harder to narrow it down. But
how did you do your research?
Well, a lot of different ways. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff online. A lot of time spent in libraries, combing through microfilm, looking at old newspapers, things like that. There are a couple of historical societies and museums in Iowa that have great stuff that you can go through. There's a little museum in Norway, Iowa, and two of the 16 players are from Norway, this little town over near Cedar Rapids. And they had all sorts of, you know, data and clippings and things like that that I could go through. So it was done in a variety of ways like that. A lot of it is just sitting in a microfilm machine in a museum and going, or in a library and going through microfilm of newspapers and looking for stuff.
How long a process was that?
Oh, it's kind of hard to pin down because a lot of it was done in little bits and pieces over many years. But when I finally decided to do it, to pull it all together, probably did it in a year, maybe a year and a half.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. The actual writing part of it, yeah. I mean, the research part of it was done in little bits and pieces for maybe 20 years. But when I pulled it all together, and it was done, my wife goes to bed at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, so a lot of this book was written between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. But
it sounds like my work schedule. At least the one I used to follow on television, because my family had all gone to bed before I finished work. And by the time I got home, well, this is a wonderful time to work because it's quiet, nobody around.
And yeah, absolutely. And I've always been a night owl. I couldn't go to bed at 9 o'clock at night if I wanted to, and I don't want to. So, that's kind of the way it worked. Once the research was done, I really pulled it together pretty quickly.
Well, now, you said that you've been doing stuff off and on for a long time. Was the germ of this, you think, way back then?
I think so. Yeah, I like I say, I've always been interested in baseball history. I've been a member of the Society for American Baseball Research since the early 1980s.
Wait a minute, what group is that?
The Society for American Baseball Research.
There is a society for research?
It's a very big organization, been around for a long time, and if you belong to that, you have access online to the sporting news all the way back to the 1880s online. You can go in there and do research that way. It's a great organization and, you know, just on websites, and there's all sorts of research access that you can get through them.
So, you ever get together and are there conferences?
There are chapters. Yeah, there's – and you know what? I've never really gotten into that part of it. There's an Iowa chapter. There's a Chicago chapter. There's probably 100 of them across the country. And they sometimes get together and do things. And to be honest, I've never really participated in those things very much. But it's a great organization and was very beneficial for this book.
What is it about baseball fans? I mean, fan is short for fanatic. And it seems once you get into baseball, your life becomes statistics.
Well, it is. It is a very statistical-oriented game. And, of course, you may have heard the term sabermetrics. All these intricate baseball, and the saber comes from the Society for American Baseball Research. They've done all of these intricate, little minute statistics to measure things, and I don't know why it is, but it is a very statistical oriented game.
Yeah, in your book of in your index, what are some players that that surprised you when you went looking for them?
Well, a gentleman named Hank Severide, who is from a little place called Story City, Iowa, north of Ames, who was a catcher. Arguably, he was the best defensive catcher who ever lived, I think. He had a season where he threw out 51 out of 53 attempted base stealers, which is unheard of. If a modern-day catcher throws out 25%, he's doing great. This guy threw out 51 out of 53. He caught more games in his era, I mean, the major and minor leagues, than anybody who ever lived. And he was featured by Ripley's, believe it or not, in the 1930s because he caught so many games. So he's a guy I knew nothing about and got into this. Unfortunately, the Story City Historical Society over this little town in central Iowa had all sorts of stuff on him that I I never knew about. And so I've really became interested in him. There's, almost every one of them in some way, there's a pitcher, a little left-handed pitcher from Cedar Rapids, Earl Whitehill, who couldn't throw very hard, wasn't very good, but was incredibly combative. There's a story about him playing golf in Arizona, and the golfer behind him hit a drive that came up and bounced between his legs, and no one had yelled for or anything, and he went racing back to the tee. Whitehill's like 5'9", 170 pounds, and he was going to fight whoever this guy was. It was Jack Dempsey, the heavyweight champion of the world. And he still was going to fight him, but his playing partners restrained him, so he didn't make a big mistake there. But, there are guys like that. He won 216 games in the major leagues, and I never knew anything at all about him. But I've really became fascinated with some of these guys.
Your remarks just sent me off on an angle I hadn't even thought about. You've been mentioning small town here and small town there. Do you think baseball is sort of the quintessential small town kid's dream?
I think it was.
Rather than basketball, which is in a court in a vacant lot in a city or something?
Especially in Iowa, if you go back, and a lot of these guys played in the 1920s and 30s too, but you go back to that era and every little town in Iowa had a team.
And a kid's dreaming about being.
Exactly. So out of these 16 major leaguers that are featured in this book, two of them are from Norway, one of them's from Orient, Iowa. I'll bet you don't know where that is.
I didn't even know there was a Norway, Iowa.
One's from Van Meter, one's from LeGrand, one is from Vinton, one's from Cascade.
Well, that can't be just accident, can it?
No, it can't. In that era, that's what kids did in small town Iowa. You went out and you played baseball every day, and obviously some of them get to be really, really good at it.
Softball came along later. And now it is perhaps the number one amateur sport around. There are more softball teams. They're playing almost every night. We have softball diamonds all around the place.
Mm-hmm.
Has that cut into hardball and baseball?
I don't know that it really has. Baseball now, it's not... kids just don't necessarily go out and play baseball every day like I did as a kid. It's much more structured and organized, and there's traveling teams and everything. So softball may have cut into it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of them go into softball and play softball for 20 years after they're done playing high school baseball or something, as I did myself. But and softball also is for girls, obviously, is a big sport too.
It is interesting the way football has edged baseball out of the prime spot. Football, we've always said that baseball is America's national sport. Now they say, no, it's football. And I look at that and I think, I understand, because the big money is in football. It has been organized very casually by some very wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
They've been given all kinds of exemptions and so on, and towns build stadiums for them out of tax money. It's just amazing.
Some of it's television ratings and things like that, but I do think baseball is kind of a slow, leisurely game, and I think maybe it doesn't appeal to some people for that reason, and maybe it's too slow, and maybe in this day and age people in their hurry-up lives don't have the patience to sit down and watch a baseball game.
In 1967 or so, Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian linguist, came out with a book called The Medium is the Message, and he predicted in 67 that within 20 or 30 years, football would vastly overtake baseball, not for any reason within the sports, but because baseball is exciting on radio.
Mm-hmm.
Football, you need to see it on television. And so with the shift to television from radio, he said football is going to win.
Mm-hmm.
That might be something to that. But football, baseball, listening to baseball is exciting.
Exactly, yeah. And you know what? Baseball has all these lulls and dead periods. And on the radio, and you had people who told stories,
right.
and things like that. Yeah. And it was more appealing, I think, that way. I think there is something to that.
Well, if you want to cut into it very carefully, baseball is still the basic American sport. It's a team sport, but there's vast room for individuals to shine in that.
Mm-hmm.
There's an individual who bats and who fields and so on. They cooperate, but it's the individual effort in a team collective. And that pretty much mirrors what we think of when we think of this country. The emphasis is on the individual,
mm-hmm.
but the individual should cooperate in society. Now, it's true that you have individual effort and so on in football, but there the quarterback and the ends and the halfbacks are the ones who really shine. The linemen have to do their work, but they generally go unnoticed.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes more of an oligarchical thing. But baseball is the true, more of a democratic operation, in that the individual really counts more. That's at least when I've tried to figure it out, that's what I came up with.
I guess I never really thought of it that way, but you're right. And everybody gets their chance to shine, whereas, as you mentioned, in football, those linemen can do a great job, and they have to do a great job for the teams to succeed, but they go unnoticed whether they do their job or not. So
yeah. It's only when they single them out in a replay, and quite often it's when they make a mistake.
Don, how did you go about getting your book published?
Well, I've actually had a previous book published by this same publisher, McFarland Publishing in Jefferson, North Carolina.
What was your other book?
It was a biography of Iron Man McGinnity, who
I've done a talk on Iron Man.
Have you really?
Yes, I have.
I wrote a book about him. It was published in 2009. And so I got involved with this publisher that way, and they were eager for me to do another one. It took me 6 years to do another one because I don't work that fast. But I had that previous book published by
McFarland.
We could
almost have the Iron Man McGinnity Award instead of the Cy Young Award, couldn't we? if I claimed the weather had been different that summer.
If you based it on durability and toughness and things like that, absolutely. There should be an Iron Man McGinnity Award.
Okay, here we go on another baseball Hot Stove League. But thank you very much, Don Doxey. Iowa Great Baseball Greats. That's the new book, and there's also one by Iron Man McGinnity by Don Doxey. Thank you very much for spending time with us, Don.
Well, thanks for having me.
And right now we go on to Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. I take it you've been reading up a storm this summer.
I have been reading up a storm this summer, yes. While you've been busy rewriting Greek drama for modern times, I've been reading.
Well, I think you have perhaps the more productive experience.
Well, I have come across some incredible books. And at the same time, I have far more books now than I had at the beginning of the summer, so I'm behind.
Oh, okay. Well, this is your moment, Roald.
Well, the book I'd like to talk about, to make sure we get it in the time, I've got a couple of other suggestions, but they can wait, is a book that Erickson gave me a couple of weeks ago, and I read it right away because it was one of the few books that made more than one or two of the bestseller lists last year. You know, we were puzzled over how many books were recommended by 20 or 30 different best books of 2015, how few repeats there were.
Yeah.
This is one that was repeated three or four times. And it's a book I probably ordinarily wouldn't have picked up, but I'm glad I did. The book is called H is for Hawk, and it's by Helen MacDonald. And I knew what it was about because I read the reviews last February. It is about a woman, Helen MacDonald, who lost her father suddenly. And as a way of coming to terms with his death and her grief, she went back to something she'd been fascinated with ever since she was eight, and that is hawks and falconry. At the age of 8 or 9, she read every book in the library there was on falconry and hawks, but she'd never actually taken it seriously. So what she did after her father died was buy a goshawk from Germany. It came in a crate, and the book is about her training the hawk to hunt, and also the hawk training her, because it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
And I did not realize how much work went into it and what kind of a bond one makes between the animal and you. She's not particularly fond of gore, and yet to run a falcon, right, you're going to kill some rabbits and you're going to kill some pheasants and a couple of pigeons in the process, and because that's what the bird eats. And I had no idea how you train a hawk to catch a pheasant and then come back to you.
Now that,
rather than eat the pheasant.
I think that would be a tough deal.
One of the real pluses in the book was it turns out that T.H. White, the author of The Once and Future King that became the musical Camelot and The Sword and the Stone, which I think most of us have seen the movie of that, he too raised falcons and kept a journal of it. He raised them badly because he too turned out to be a fairly mixed up person, unsure of himself, unsure of his direction, a loner. And so I learned more about T.H. White, which all of a sudden really makes sense out of The Sword and the Stone and The Once and Future King in a way that it hadn't before. I read those books and I liked them, but this is a story of T.H. White as well as a story of Helen MacDonald and her falcon. And it doesn't end dramatically. I mean, it takes you through a year of training the falcon, and then it turns out that during the winter when or during the molting season when you can't run your falcon, you take him to an aviary, and the aviary takes care of him until the feathers are back, and then you go back and get your falcon and start training him all over again.
I didn't realize such places existed.
But, I mean, you know, first of all, it is really well written and sensitively written. The description of the nature and the landscape and the hawk hunting and the hawk itself and different kinds of hawks, you know, what kind of hawk do you want to hunt with? And a little bit of the history of falconry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have any desire to have a falcon and let it hunt, but I sure enjoyed this book.
Yeah, boy, that does sound off the beaten track and most unusual. The author and the title again?
Is Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk.
H is for Hawk, okay. And with that, we're going to, I guess T is for time. We must leave you now, but there's always next week. I'm Don Wooten with the Roll Tweet. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week for another session of Scribble.